from. My name is Tim Reed. My age is 77. Today's date is March 10, 2020. We are in Las Cruces, New Mexico. And the name of my interview partner is Vicky Aldrich. My relationship to the partner is spousal.
My name is Vicky Aldrich. My age is 68. Today's date is March 10th, 2020. We're in Las Cruces, New Mexico. And the name of my interview partner is Tim Reed. And our relationship is spouses.
Well, Vicky, one of the reasons that we're here is because you've gone and you found some information about your World War II dad's service in what could be called the military. He was going to be drafted, and after thinking it over, he said, I'm going to do alternative service. And so you found some information they didn't even know existed. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, after my parents died, and my dad died in 2007 and my mom in 2008, my sisters, we ended up just taking different things. And when we were out in Tennessee at one of my sister's houses, we went through these boxes and we thought, oh, we'll find some letters from mom or something. But we found 184 letters that my father wrote home during World War II that he wrote back to his parents. And so I'm kind of using some of those as some prompts. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so they take place from 1942 to 1946, mm-hmm. when he was discharged.
Did you see you had 182?
Yeah, 184.
184 letters that are preserved from that, yeah. from those dates.
Yeah.
Yeah. And is there anyone that particularly you'd like to start off sharing?
Well, and then I found this other little thing that he got interviewed once about why he became a conscientious objector. And he says, because of religious training and belief, I refused to bear arms. I'd grown up in an Iowa farm community, and all my life I'd gone to Peyton Friends Church, a pastoral Friends Church. I didn't have any trouble in my own mind about being a conscientious objector to war. I had no interest at all in killing any of the people the government said were our enemies. And so he ended up in this program that existed during World War II, and it was kind of unique to that period, called Civilian Public Service. Mm-hmm. And evidently they weren't paid, so he was in for 3.5 years and as an unpaid service, and he served in a number of different places.
Mm-hmm. And where did he first show up?
He first started off at a camp in Coshocton, Ohio. And so he wrote from there in August, and he's about 24 years old. I think he's between 24 and 28. And he said they had a lot of different men there. They were from ages 22 to 28, 25 different denominations, Methodists, Quakers, no denomination, and Jehovah's Witnesses. And in World War II, I think to be a conscientious objector, you had to show that it was religiously based. Mm-hmm. You couldn't just do it on any old thing. And I think they got hassled a little bit in Coshocton. Then he went on and went to Oregon after about 4 months. One interesting thing I thought that was in here too was that he wrote back about his sugar books. They had to have rations. He says, you'll find my sugar book in the letter. This is writing to his parents. Seems that they don't need them to get sugar for the camp. So if you can manage to get sugar with it, you might use some of it to make me some candy or cookies. You could send it in those tin film boxes that we got at the fair. His family wasn't too bad off during this period.
Is there an approximate date on that?
That was 1942, yeah. October of 42. So,
And what's next?
What's
yeah, this is interesting.
Well, then, and then the camps were doing different types of work, and in Coshocton, they were doing conservation work of land because it's farmland. And he said at this point, this is October again of 42, I found out 25% of the topsoil is now gone off the Corn Belt. Most of it is in the Gulf of Mexico. And that this dam at Keokuk is now 30% covered up and was only built in 1913. So I just thought that was interesting because we talk about that kind of stuff now.
Yeah.
And here they were talking about it in the 1940s.
And next up we have something.
And then, well, he gets, they switch off and they send him to Oregon. And he's only lived in Iowa. I think he'd been to Iowa and to Chicago and stuff, but he hadn't been out of the Midwest. So they end up taking a train. They take a train to Oregon. And so I've got a couple, there were a couple things about that train trip. It says, just started to see some real mountains. Oh, and this is, this one isn't, well, it's in December, I guess, of 42. Started to see some real mountains. We're stopped for a little at Bozeman, Montana. It's now 1 p.m. The snow's almost gone here. Just a little where it has been drifted. We can see mountains with lots of snow on them all around us. Our elevation's about 4,773 feet. We will go higher yet. Our car is near the front of the train, and the diner is at the rear. We have to tramp almost the full length of the train. The people gape at us and wonder what we are. 39 men without uniforms. Some of them have found out what we are, and only one guy called us anything. Now we think we will get to camp Sunday night or Monday morning.
And that was 1942?
Yeah, yeah. And then there's just a little bit more about after he got there, he kind of describes the mountains a bit more.
Mm-hmm.
He says, boy, oh boy, have things ever been happening. The last couple of weeks, today's Thursday, the day before Christmas, and a week ago yesterday, I was about 3,000 miles from here with snow all around, and now I'm in Oregon, and there isn't a bit of snow, and it rains nearly all the time. Since I arrived here last Monday morning, I don't believe it has stopped raining for over 4 or 5 hours at one time. He says, there's no use me trying to tell about traveling through the mountains. They are beyond description. We didn't go through any very high mountains. Only 6,000 feet are over at the highest, but they were plenty impressive anyway. I thought I would catch up on my sleep on the train, but I couldn't tear myself away from the window till it got so dark I couldn't see anything. In fact, a couple of nights we had a good moon, and I looked out of the window till about 11 when I got so sleepy that I couldn't see.
I'll bet you can imagine him there.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's why we ended up in Colorado after the war, is he loved the mountains so much.
Yeah. And so are his next letters from Idaho?
Oregon.
Are his next letters from somewhere I remember?
Yeah. Yeah. So then he spends most of the time in Oregon, and then at the end, he ends up in Chicago. Here is another mention of the sugar, his sugar ration book. He says, I don't have much to say. I really wrote to get you to send my sugar ration book. It seems they haven't got this camp on an institutional basis. I think they will after a while, but they want our books, so I guess you'll have to give it up. Maybe I'll get it back before long. My tin coat and hat came. And they had something that they were called, that they called a tin coat, which I guess is really waterproof.
Mm-hmm.
Must have just been real heavy. And so they'd ordered it from Monkey Ward's, Montgomery Ward's.
Well, he called it Monkey Ward's in the letter, didn't he?
Yeah, he did.
Yeah.
But yeah. I don't even think it, I don't know, does it still exist?
I have no idea.
It's Montgomery Ward's. It was like Sears, which is now like Amazon or whatever, right? Somewhere you could order things from.
Yeah.
And so then he talks a little bit about his job. I got into a real good job. I'm in charge of the camp wood shop, which means that I'm a sort of official carpenter and handyman to fix most anything. I really love that kind of work, and it will be mostly dry, too. There's a lot of swell woodworking equipment here. And then he gets into some of these details that I'm not always interested in, what types of boards and tools and everything are in the workshop.
Mm-hmm. How old was he at that time, about?
24.
24, okay.
Now we're into 1943.
And you found something?
Oh, right, because, well, there was a little bit of talk about how the camps were run. And I don't know all the details, but evidently the historic churches, peace churches, the Quakers, Brethren, and the Mennonites talked with the government and said, you know, we don't want people in prison who are conscience objectors. And so they agreed to run the camps. And so here he was talking about, some people thought, well, maybe the government should be running these camps where the conscientious objectors are working, doing this. They were doing forestry work here. He said, if the government was to maintain a camp for a few men, it would have to come out of the money appropriated for the selective service. And they would not have enough to last them. Then they would have come to Congress for more money. And that would give those against us a chance to start thinking what good we could do if we were to all work in the munitions plants or something. So they really kind of felt it was a good idea to keep the government out of it because they weren't really supportive of the conscientious conscientious objection.
Easy for you to say. And you found something else.
And I was thinking of somewhere about that we were, I'm not sure where we were reading it, Tim, and maybe it was in another book, that there was something like 52,000 conscientious objectors in World War II, and 12,000 of them were in these camps, and the others were non-combatants, served within the military as non-combatants.
And he was one of them, of that group that did not serve in the military. He served in the CPS camp.
Yeah, right. And then this one, he works in the workshop, and then he starts getting some other jobs. So he gets a job as on a survey crew, where they're going out and surveying land for the Forest Service.
Mm-hmm. Anything interesting in that?
Yeah. I guess I told you, he says, dear folks, he's in Oncola, Oregon, June 6, 1943. Guess I told you there were eight of us CPSers on the crew and a government engineer. Out of the eight men, there's one instrument man, one truck driver, one corner man, two chain men, and three axemen. I'm an axeman. We have light, double-bitted, short-handled axes that work pretty good in the brush. We axemen carve a good enough trail out of the wilderness for the chainmen to follow. That isn't a very clear path, either. We just cut off the worst of it. The chain that I speak of is a steel tape 330 feet long, divided into 500 parts called links. We slide down and climb up slopes that run from 20 degrees to 40 degrees slant. It's pretty hard work, but interesting and not monotonous. I like it pretty well. We see some pretty big trees once in a while, but most of them aren't as big, only 2 or 3 feet. Did I tell you about our beds? One day when it was raining, we started to make beds. Some of the fellows made theirs out of some old canvas we had, but I made one out of a couple of poles with small sticks across and fir boughs over them, almost as soft as a mattress. It isn't bad at all. I sleep very well. I've taken 2 baths in our creek. It's pretty cold, but it gets you clean. I've washed some of my clothes, too. We're away from the luxury of washing machines.
And you had not run across this information. He didn't talk about it.
Well,
when you were younger, did he?
I think he might have talked and we didn't listen, you know.
That could have been.
The way kids are, sometimes you don't listen.
Mm-hmm.
My sisters and I will get together now and we'll say, now, what was it? Who was this relative? Or what was this thing they would always tell us? And We didn't always pay attention. But we didn't know that the letters, you know, that the letters were there are some of these details. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then he got on the, after he got, he spent that whole summer. So that's his first summer up out there in Oregon. And he spent that summer on that survey crew going up through the mountains. And they were kind of roughing it a lot. And then after that, he ended up on some fire crews. So they were fighting the forest fires in the fall that we all now hear about all the time in the
Was he assigned to the crew, to the fire crew from the Forest Service, from the survey crew?
I don't think so. Last Wednesday we went to a fire. He talks about people getting assigned, you know, to different tasks.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. Yeah, I think they just asked for people to volunteer, and he seemed to like to do the really active, more demanding work.
Yeah, running around with a two-bit axe, short handle is hard.
Yeah.
And what's this?
And this was another one of these stamps. This was about the shoe stamp. He said, I'm enclosing my shoe stamp. I don't need it, and I'll bet some of you can use it. The ration board has all of our books. They issue us a special shoe stamp when we want to get shoes. So he filled it out, and he got this stamp, and was he said he actually decided he couldn't use it, but he thought that he had. My dad had four brothers and sisters, and back home, and so he felt that they could use it.
So that the ration book, or in rationing stamps, were a pretty direct connection with the government system.
I guess so.
Yeah.
I don't know any more about it.
I think it's a fair conclusion.
Yeah, that sounds like it.
Even though he doesn't say so, but nonetheless. What's the next thing? You've got some interesting stuff here.
Well, this was a mention of guns. I just thought that was interesting because he said the deer hunting season is on now. One of the fellows shot one. We haven't had any yet. It seems that they have to let it age a few days to get the best flavor. It was a 5-year-old buck, and they had about 150 pounds of dressed meat. That guy was really proud. He killed it with a .22 rifle and was about 2 miles from one of the spike camps and had to have some of the other fellows help him carry it in. I think they had a main camp, and then they had these other smaller camps out in the ways that would do tree planting, or they would be doing the fire lookouts and stuff. But I thought this was interesting because I think a lot of times people think about pacifists or conscientious objectors and people that hate guns and hate killing, and my dad never minded killing animals. And a lot of these people did, you know, believe in hunting but not believe in using guns to kill people. And that one was followed. So now we're up to October of 43. And this little bit was about earning some money. And he said, because he's the only money he has for clothes and things he has to get from home. And so he says, I let a fellow talk me into doing some carpenter work for some nice people in Eugene. And that's in Oregon. I had worked overtime and had a couple of days coming, so I went up on a weekend leave. That's not the same as furlough. I went up 2 weeks ago, last weekend, and again last Saturday and Sunday. I'm not done yet. There was another guy went along last time, and we both worked on it. We get 75 cents an hour, but I hate to take their money. So we did 12 hours and only charged for 10. I need some shirts and socks so I can use a little money. But I just thought that was interesting because I thought, here's these people that are probably trying to help out these guys that are in the camps. And then, meanwhile, the guys are not wanting to take the money, so they're doing this, not charging for as many hours.
Yeah, but it also points out that if you're in a CPS camp at that time, when that was 43, that you weren't getting paid for anything.
Right.
You're working hard, but all you got was a roof over your head.
Yeah.
And some
yeah,
food.
I think they got some food, but then they were. This next part is a bit about the hogs. So they were raising some of their own food. He says, and he's also on the work committee. I'm the chairman of the work committee. It's kept me busy this week. The business of the committee is the placing of the right men in the right jobs. That's like you were asking about, how did he get on this crew? Mm-hmm. When there's a new job, any place like a timber cruising job somewhere or a vacancy in the drafting room or anything connected with the work, it's the business of the work committee. Where it caught me was Monday, there was supposed to be 30 men to leave for a tree planting. Well, we found out last Sunday that the camp wasn't ready for people to live in it, not till Wednesday. I had to get things lined up for about 15 men to do. And before they got away, there were 18 men that came through that they'd been accepted for detached service. That called for another shuffle. It kept me busy getting things lined up. And it's kind of cooled off now. Then at the end of this letter, he says, I should say where we are to, November, it's November of 43. I gutted my first hog last Tuesday. Another guy stuck it, but he's gone, so I suppose I'll have to stick the next one. I'm assuming that means killing the pig, the hog. We kill one every Tuesday. We have had three and have seven big ones left, and then we will have to wait for some more to grow up. The first ones we killed figured out that the dressed meat cost us 14 cents a pound. So we got 19 little pigs. It's a good business. Meat tastes good, too.
A little side business there. And then from there, we go to something else.
Well, the next note I have is about the Japanese. Should I do that one?
Well, but sure. Let me ask you the question then. Did your dad and his camp have any connection with the interned people or Japanese children and parents?
Yeah, they did, because I think there was an internment camp not too far from them, mm-hmm. for the Japanese that were interred during World War II. And so he says that they started making toys for the Japanese American kids in relocation centers. And my dad was in charge of the workshop. And he says, I haven't really been making any of them, but I get mixed up in everybody's toys. So I can imagine that he was helping them, mm-hmm. figure out how to do it. Mm-hmm. One fellow who's a very good mechanic made a small steam engine that runs off electricity. And one guy's wife is visiting in camp, and she's a designer. Her specialty is toys. She's been working on the toy business for the Japanese and has designed a new set of blocks while she's out here. So, yeah, so they would... As people would come to visit them, and they could make these toys, and other people would take them, mm-hmm. down to the kids that were in the internment camp. And they, at one point in here too, he said that they were getting the conscious objectors to help with the harvest and with picking things like prunes and stuff. And they all said, well, if they simply let out, but I think there was like 120,000 Japanese in the camps. They could have helped with. Mm-hmm. With the farm work as well, but that wasn't the way that it happened. Oh, and then here was a little thing on a Christmas celebration. Does that sound interesting?
What date is that?
That's December. How about December 25th, 1943?
That sounds like a Christmas day, doesn't it?
The day before Christmas. I've been out here over a year. I didn't think when I came out here that I'd stay in the camp that long. I guess I've been comparatively happy here, probably as happy as I could be anywhere during a war. Life outside isn't what it used to be, with rationing and shortages and propaganda. We do lead a somewhat sheltered life. We all somewhat agree and can say what we think about events. And that's actually the 24th. The next day, he says, we had a nice Christmas party, Friday night. Quite a few of the fellows were in from the side camps, and I got to see some of my old friends that I hadn't seen for several months. Some of the more musical boys had gotten up a swell musical program that was done very impressively with different colored lights. One of the best Christmas programs I've ever seen. There's a lot of talent in CPS. We had a nice big turkey dinner Saturday, and there was enough candy around, so I wasn't hungry when it came time for supper. In the evening, we all went over to the director's apartment, and one of the fellows read Dickens' Christmas Carol. I thought we had a good Christmas. We would have rather been home, but we enjoyed what we had.
I suspect they did, considering that the guys in the trenches weren't having such a great time.
Yeah, and then they were getting a little worried about at one time he was really worried about the CPS and that it might not last. I think this was, I mean, this whole thing was kind of an experiment. In World War I, I think they didn't have this type of program, and so this was something new. He says, if CPS should collapse and they might take a notion to let us all work in the shipyards or something that I wouldn't want to do, they are getting a little hard up for men now. If somebody would happen to notice all of us nice, able-bodied guys just fooling around doing work of national importance, they might get somebody to revise the meaning of national importance. He says to his folks, don't worry about that, though. And that's February of 44. And some of the guys didn't feel that the work they were doing was that important, and some people volunteered for things like the starvation experiments and stuff, where they would voluntarily be starved and stuff like that. But go ahead.
Well, didn't your father tell you anything about that? Or?
Well, he knew some of the people who did that, and I think it did impact some of their health and stuff. So my dad did live to be 89. He had a good long life. And so much of his life got determined partly, I think, by some of this, because he ended up as a remodeling. He had a remodeling business. He ended up doing carpentry. And here's a statement he had on religion and war. I'm more than ever sure that, at least for me, war is wrong, and I'm sure that it is wrong for the world as a way to settle differences. I can't see anything in a religion that lets people kill other people and in some cases strengthens them. I'm not going back on my religion, but I sure think that Christ has been one of the most misunderstood and misinterpreted men that ever lived.
And so from there, now what year was that?
We're in 44 now.
Yeah, and so the worry about the CPS camps collapsing, that was in 44 as well.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm not sure which other stories we should tell here. I'm not quite.
Well, how about, how did he find out that he was discharged?
Okay, so that's at the end. We can go back and forth here. He goes to Chicago in 45 and 46. They know that they're going to have to disperse these camps, and so they start sending people out on what they call detached service. And so he ends up in Chicago working for an organization called the American Friends Service Committee. It's the same organization that was running the camps. Mm-hmm. But in Chicago, they're running, and in 45, 46, they're running a big thing of collecting clothing and things to send to Europe as Europe needs to recover. And he says that the news is that I found out that I've been a free man since the 23rd of this month, but I don't have the proof yet, as there's a lot of red tape to go through that. It's hard to get done, as I'm in a different place than the records are. You see, my records are in Bowie, Maryland, and my headquarters are Philadelphia, and I'm in Chicago. I got a note from Kit the other day, he was one of the administrators at the camp, telling me that I had been released as of the 23rd, that he was to complete filling out the form, and he couldn't do it till he got my file from Bowie. I've been waiting for the papers and looking in the mail every day, but nothing yet. I'm not so excited about being free, as I forgot all about it before tonight anyway. I've been so free here, and I'm going to stay on in the same work, so being out of CPS isn't going to make much difference in my life, except now I'm getting paid at the rate of $140 a month, and also I get to pay some tax, too.
If I may?
Yeah.
What month was that?
That was February of 46.
February 46.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I think it's kind of funny that he says it's not a lot different, but he's getting paid. So yeah. I think money was not a big motivation in his life.
Right. Yep. I know him, and it didn't seem to be a driving force.
No.
This that was before today's date, being March 10. And the,
did you want to share the item you had about March 10th?
Yes. Do you want to interview me?
Sure, Tim. What did you read to me this morning about March 10th?
I read, on this day in 1987, the United Nations recognized conscientious objection as a human right. This is 1987. Conscientious objectors is defined as a refusal on moral and or religious grounds to bear arms in military conduct or to serve in armed forces. This recognition by the United Nations established the right as a part of every person's freedom of thought, conscience, and or religion. And to back that up, previously there was an effort in the U.S. government to make some recognition, and there's some more data there, but I'll go to a quote of John F. Kennedy, who was a U.S. president, and he stressed the importance of this U.N. resolution when he wrote these words to a friend: "War will exist until that distant day when the conscientious objector enjoys the same reputation and prestige that the warrior does today."
Yeah, I thought that was good.
And we are done two minutes before.
We
Five
have
minutes
ten,
before.
We have 10 minutes.
Oh, I'll be darned.
You know, and I thought, I mean, there's a couple of things I didn't share in here. One was that there was a note, too, about the Quaker colleges that offered half off tuition. And I didn't know this. I looked at these letters once before, but in getting ready for this, I noticed some things I hadn't seen before. But the people who did the alternative service, who did this civilian public service, they did not get the GI Bill or mm-hmm. or the veterans benefits that mm-hmm. the other people did. So I thought that was kind of interesting.
Well, what did your dad do after the war?
Well, he married my mom.
And that was something
we were saying, too, about, because I remember one of the questions was, how did your life, you know, get mm-hmm. impacted by these stories?
Mm-hmm.
He met my mom at the place in Chicago where they were doing the clothing. My mother was a secretary there.
Mm-hmm.
And so at that time, that same letter where he wrote back about getting discharged, he says, "Just to get used to the idea, I might warn you that when I do come home, I'll bring a very special girl with me. Didn't think that I would warn you, as I knew that Mom would knock herself out cleaning. But I thought that the shock might be too great, so don't you dare do any extra work, Mom." She says, "Her name is Dorothy Edwards, works in the service committee office. Dad met her when he was here. Don't confuse her with the girl. It was somebody else," he said. But yeah, they met it in 40 and 45, 46,
mm-hmm.
at the end of the war, and they got married. And my mom, on my mother's side of the family, one of her brothers had not become a conscientious, he tried to become a conscientious objector, and he ended up in prison because somehow his things didn't fit. But then later on, he got out of prison and accepted taking, supervising a boatload of cows going to Europe, which was always kind of a family joke because that uncle grew up in Chicago, and so here was my dad from the farm working in Chicago, and the one who didn't know anything about cows was taking him off to Europe.
What did your uncle finally wind up doing?
He became an economics professor in Ohio.
Yeah.
But for some reason, his younger brother did get conscientious objector status.
Mm.
But they're also, in the camps, they did a lot of talk about cooperatives. And so my parents talked about living cooperatively on a farm. But I think they went there and then other people didn't show up. And now maybe that's the reason those other people went to college, is because they did get a discount so they could go. But it really did impact my life. Both the values of doing the hard work and service that I think he showed during the war years, and also the commitment to peace,
mm-hmm.
that I think has impacted me as well. That mm-hmm. I
well, it's really, in a sense, created your family because he found his wife in Chicago.
Yeah, that's true.
And it wasn't through an ad. And
yeah.
And he wanted to go to Colorado because of the mountains.
Yeah.
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 And is there? I noticed that you have. You've only touched a few of the notes that you've made with this book. And how many pages are there in this book?
I don't know. We had a friend who typed up the letters for us, and mm-hmm. I don't think she. Well, she didn't. She did number them. There's over 300.
Then does that mean there have been 300 letters?
There was 184.
184 letters.
Yeah. Because somewhere she left lots of space, and there were postcards too. And mm-hmm. he had a typewriter, so a lot of them were typed, and others that were handwritten mm-hmm. and postcards and stuff. So, yeah.
Well, that is amazing. Is there anything you'd like to? We're done.
Ask a question?
Yeah.
Can you tell Tim about what it means to you to have that artifact of your family history?
Oh, yeah, It really means a lot to me to have these letters, and it does have our friend's name on it. So they were typed in 2009, and because then it gives us that reference, that story, and I think those stories and knowing those stories are important, especially stories that don't get told that much, that often throughout our lives. So.
And when you discovered the cache, which was recently after your parents were dead. Do you remember the response and how it felt to discover here is this this treasure of history?
Yeah, it was kind of overwhelming. And then I read them, and it's interesting to have looked at them again because mm-hmm. that was 11 years ago. Mm-hmm. And now I can see things I didn't appreciate then. So actually having this opportunity allowed me to go back and look at that and learn some things I hadn't learned the first time. Yeah, so thank you.
Do we do a formal conclusion? No. We done that. Oh, 5 minutes.
No.